Coming up on this week's book show, Patrick Radden Keefe, a staff writer for The New Yorker, is the author of the best-selling Say Nothing. Keefe looks at the disappearance of Jean McConville, a widowed young mother of 10 children, and explores the broader context of the terrorism and counterterrorism campaigns over the course of The Troubles and what happened to the perpetrators and the victims of this crime. Patrick Radden Keefe on this week's book show. Welcome to The Book Show, a celebration of reading and writers. I'm Joe Donahue. Patrick Radden Keefe, a staff writer for The New Yorker, is the author of the best-selling Say Nothing, a true story of murder and memory in Northern Ireland. Keefe researched an appalling crime that took place over the course of the three-decade Troubles in Northern Ireland, the disappearance of Jean McConville, a widowed young mother of 10 children. Keefe explores the shocking history of McConville's disappearance, the broader context of the terrorism and the counterterrorism campaigns in Northern Ireland over the course of the Troubles, and what happened to the perpetrators and the victims of the crime. Say Nothing conjures a world of passion, betrayal, vengeance, and anguish. To tell us more about that world, we welcome Patrick Radden Keefe to this week's book show. Patrick, thank you very much for being with us. A great pleasure to have you on the program.
Oh, thanks so much for having me.
This book had an amazing impact on me, and I can't tell you how much I enjoyed reading it. It's fascinating and disturbing and just a searing work. I'm curious as to what was the spark that said to you, okay, there's a story here, a story that I can tell.
You know, it started as an article in The New Yorker magazine. The way I stumbled upon the story, you know, you would think with a name like Patrick Keefe, I might have had some personal connection to Ireland or the Troubles, which is not the case at all. I came across this in the context of my day job, looking for an article that I could write in The New Yorker, and I happened upon an obituary in 2013 of this woman, Dolores Price, who'd been kind of an IRA soldier during the Troubles and had lived this very colorful, dramatic life. And the obituary mentioned that Dolores Price had played a part in the abduction and murder of this woman, Jean McConville, a widowed mother of 10, who was taken away from her apartment in Belfast in 1972 and murdered and secretly buried. So her kids grew up not knowing what had happened to their mother, and all of them orphaned. That was the start of it for me. That was the spark, this idea that you could tell a story of these two very different women, one of them a victim and one of them a perpetrator, and look at how they were joined by that one act of violence and sort of look at the reverberations of that act of violence for the victims and the perpetrators down through the decades.
Jean McConville was 38 years old when she was killed. Why did she become an iconic victim? What was it about her story?
Well, there were about 3,600 people who lost their lives over the course of the Troubles over three decades, which is, you know, it's either a lot of people or not a lot, depending on how you look at it. If you look at, you know, what's happening in Syria right now, or you look at the drug war in Mexico, 3,600 people is not that many over three decades. But you got to remember that Northern Ireland's a very tiny place. And what you find when you go there is that everybody knows everybody. And so each of those, you know, any act of violence, any loss of life is a tragedy. But in a small country like that, the ripples of each act of violence are really felt, and they kind of overlap and they intersect. And In the case of Jean McConville, I think, you know, they sometimes talk about in Northern Ireland the notion of a hierarchy of victims. And the suggestion is basically that people will often essentially pick a side and they'll say, you know, we're the ones who are the real martyrs here. If it was one of ours who lost their life, you know, my tragedy is the greatest tragedy. And your tragedy, well, you guys are all kind of implicated in one way or another, so it doesn't matter as much. And I think that Jean McConville was so iconic in part just because she's a woman. She was a mother of 10. She was a widow. And she was disappeared. So there was a kind of extra cruelty in the idea that one squeeze of the trigger kills her and orphans 10 children. And as if that's not bad enough, they don't have a body that they can bury. They don't have a grave that they can go to and mourn. You know, a bunch of the kids grew up thinking that their mother might come back. They didn't want to leave Belfast because they held that hope that she'd just run off or she had amnesia and that someday she would come home.
You refer to that as a purgatory of uncertainty, which seems just awful.
It does, and it lasted for decades. You know, I spent time interviewing some of her kids, and the tragedy and the trauma of that is all over their faces even today.
So what was it about her background? They believed that she was an informant, right? That was the reason that was thought of why she was killed.
Yeah, I mean, it's one of these things, right, when you hear about the idea that the IRA would take away this woman who's trying to care for her 10 kids, it does beg the question, why? Why would they kill her? And when the IRA, decades later, acknowledged having done this, what they did was they said, yes, we murdered Jean McConville and buried her in a secret grave. The reason we did it is because she was an informant for the British Army. And they were very, very adamant about that. And I should say, her children, throughout this whole time, over all these decades, have been very, very consistent and adamant in denying that that's the case. They say, this is sort of a slander of our dead mother to suggest that she was implicated, that she was an informant. Nothing could be further from the truth. I honestly don't know with any certainty what the truth is. What I try to do in the book is lay out the arguments and the evidence on both sides. I cannot say with great certainty whether she was an informant one way or the other.
And not to be damning to the children and all, but it's very possible that they just couldn't know, right?
Absolutely, and this is part of the reason that I hope the book is a good read and you don't get too bogged down, but it's based on a lot of pretty rigorous research. And one thing for me as a reporter is just that I try not to get out over my skis. I try not to make claims that I'm not able to substantiate. There are other places in the book where I make claims about certain people and things they did and things they didn't do.
Right.
And, you know, you can believe me or not, but I hope you sort of trust my process, right? Which is, I wouldn't be saying this unless I was sure. But what that means is that in Jean McConville's case, as much as it might be what I would want to do out of sympathy for the children to say very definitively she wasn't an informant, looking at the evidence, I don't feel capable of doing that. But by the same token, I'm also not entirely persuaded by the evidence that she was. So I think readers will have to decide for themselves.
Patrick Radden Keefe is our guest on this week's book show. The name of the book is Say Nothing, A True Story of Murder and Memory in Northern Ireland. And the book has just been released in paperback. We hear the story of Jean McConville. And then, as you mentioned at the beginning, we welcome Dolores Price into this conversation. How did she get involved with the IRA and ultimately become the first woman admitted to the front lines of the IRA?
So Dolores grew up in this interesting family. She grew up in a family of Irish Republicans. Going back on both sides, going back generations, her family had been in or had supported the IRA, the Irish Republican Army. They believed that for hundreds of years, the British had been occupying the island of Ireland, that, you know, for a time, Britain controlled all of Ireland. And then after the Irish War for Independence, there were these six counties in the north. There was a partition of Ireland. These six counties in the north remain part of the UK. Everyone in Dolores's family believed that if you were Irish, you had a duty, really, you know, from birth, to do everything you could to eject the British by any means necessary. And what that meant in practice is that both of her parents had been to prison. Her father had gone off and bombed England in the 1940s. And so she's raised in this very militaristic culture. And there was this strange thing that happened, which is that in the late 1960s, as tensions really intensify and sharpen in Northern Ireland, and you get the outbreak of the Troubles, initially Dolores and her younger sister kind of rebelled. But rebellion in that family meant saying, you know, what if we gave peace a chance? What if we didn't necessarily resort to violence as the means of getting what we want? But they went on a peaceful protest march, and they were on this march, and they ended up actually getting beaten up by a mob of loyalists, so people who were loyal to the British crown. It was after that and a few other events that the sisters ended up joining the IRA. And so it was kind of, you know, Dolores described it as a homecoming. She'd rebelled against the ways of her family, and then she has this homecoming, and she joins the IRA. And as you said, she, you know, up to that point, women, including her mother and her aunts, had a kind of auxiliary role in the IRA. They would help hide weapons. They would, you know, bandage wounded men, but they were kind of behind the scenes. And Dolores came in and said, I don't want to do that. Uh-uh. You know, I want whatever job you would give to a man. And they let her in. They let her in on those terms. And what that meant was carrying a gun and running operations, planting bombs. And she did so.
And it seems in your telling of this story that as she's doing that, and as this homecoming is happening to her, there are also fundamental shifts that are happening within the IRA.
Yes. You had a split in the IRA that took place at around this time, in which there was a perception that the IRA had become a little too complacent, that it, you know, it wasn't well enough armed, that it had gone too political. And as tensions escalate and you start getting riots and mobs and Catholics getting burned out of their houses, there was an offshoot that basically said, look, we got to be out here protecting the community and bringing the fight to the loyalists and to the British. And so you had the development of what was called the Provisional IRA. And when we talk about the IRA today, basically we mean the Provisional IRA. They're sometimes called the Provos. And this was a much more aggressive, more heavily armed group. And that was the group that Dolores joined. So they're just much more kinetic, and they really wanted to get out there and be on the front lines and fight.
Escalate, escalate, escalate is how you put it in the book.
That was the motto. Yeah, that was the motto of one of their leaders. And you can see that that was pretty much what happened with the Price sisters. They both join, and within a year or two, they are targeting people for execution. They're smuggling explosives across the border and eventually leading a bombing mission to London.
And they had a certainty, didn't they, that anything they did was justified for the cause?
Yes. I mean, that's one of the deep themes of the book, is that I wanted to look at the process of radicalization and also just the idea of a kind of radical political conviction which can justify almost anything. And so as young women, both sisters basically said, look, we're going to sign up and in for a penny, in for a pound. We want to get the Brits out. And in order to do that, we're comfortable killing people. We're comfortable planting bombs in public places. We'll risk our own lives. We'll see friends die. We'll go on hunger strike, which both of the sisters did. And there was a sense that it was kind of a transaction, right? That you might even be martyred. You might go to prison forever. You might die in action. But it was worth it because you had this pretty clean political objective, which is, you know, they wanted to do what generations of their family had not succeeded in doing, which is, you know, achieve Irish unification and expel the British.
And it seems that another theme of the book is what happens if you are not martyred young? What happens to you? What do you become?
Yeah, this was one of my big questions. And part of what drew me to the story in the first place was just that, you know, they were all obsessed with martyrs. A lot of these young IRA members, they'd grown up steeped in kind of Catholic iconography of martyrdom. But then also in their own lives, you know, they all had pictures of Che Guevara on the wall. Part of what was intriguing to me was this idea of what happens if you don't get martyred. How do you feel when you look back? Conflict changes. You're no longer on the front lines. You get out of prison. Maybe you get married. You have children of your own. So these impetuous young radicals who thought they could do anything and were so devoted and had such conviction in their early 20s, how do they feel in their 40s? How do they feel in their 50s? Mm. And so part of what I wanted to do is kind of track that over the decades.
that devotion, that conviction, there comes a glamour that you write about, an excitement that is happening at this time. You write of that glamour, if you will, without glamorizing the subject. And I assume that that would be a challenge to do.
That was, you really put your finger on it. That was one of the biggest challenges I wrestled with this book, because if you look at the way in which people tend to write about terrorism in general, I would say, and the IRA in particular, it's often, you know, the discourse is always a little stilted, because I think there are people who see Gerry Adams or the IRA as just these kind of unequivocal heroes who were doing the right thing. And then there are other people who just see them as a bunch of terrorists who went out and killed people and were bloodthirsty and pretty unequivocally bad. Part of what I wanted to do was get close enough that you could really understand these people, which isn't to let them off the hook at all. But I just wanted the book to feel intimate, as though you were right there with them. And the challenge there is, when you're looking at what it is that would make somebody who's just a couple of years out of high school start carrying a gun or put a massive car bomb on a crowded street in London, or starve themselves almost to death, you know, till Dolores Price at a certain point on her hunger strike weighed 75 pounds. You look at what makes somebody do those things, and what I found pretty quickly was, you know, some of it was their sort of righteous fervor, but some of it was romance and glamour and a sense of adventure and camaraderie and excitement. And so I think the trick for me was, if you don't capture that, you're not actually explaining fully how it is these people got into this. So I'd be sort of, I think, shortchanging the reader if I just tried to skip over that somehow or suppress it. But if you capture the romance and the glamour, like how do you not appear to be romanticizing or glamorizing what they did yourself? And the answer for me was never to lose sight of the human costs of what they were doing. And to also, to some degree, to structure the book in such a way that, you know, in the first third of the book, you do get a lot of that kind of headlong excitement of those early years. And in the last third of the book, you get the hangover. You know, you get people who are still suffering physically and mentally from the things that they've done. You get people who are just haunted and have lost a great deal. You get a lot of people with PTSD, people with alcohol problems, people who are suicidal. And I felt as though the only way to honestly do the first thing, which is to show you the kind of seductiveness of that revolutionary lifestyle, is to also do the second thing and show you the costs.
Patrick Radden Keefe is our guest on this week's book show. The book Say Nothing, A True Story of Murder and Memory in Northern Ireland is just out in paperback. It is published by Anchor Books. You talk about getting to the truth and getting to know these people and these characters that you write about. And maybe I'm wrong on this, but it seems in reading the book, obviously a major figure in this book is Gerry Adams. It seems that after all this time and you're writing about him, and again, maybe I'm reading too much into this, but you still really don't know what to make of the guy.
Yeah, I mean, he's such a great, great character. If you were writing a novel, you'd be hard-pressed to come up with a more complex, fascinating character. I think Adams is a cipher. I think he has been to some degree his whole life. I think he's a very cerebral, kind of emotionally chilly, somewhat cold-blooded human being. And Adams is another person who, if you look at the literature of the Troubles and you look at press coverage, you really, it kind of only comes in two flavors. You know, there's Gerry Adams, the hero who should have won the Nobel Prize, and there's Gerry Adams, the Antichrist. For me, the truth was always much more complicated, and that's part of what makes him interesting, is that he's a guy who was the commanding officer in the IRA of people like Dolores Price, who gave orders for them to commit terrible war crimes, and then who at a certain point saw, you know, we're not going to fight the British into the sea. We need to come up with a political solution here. And went completely political and started denying he'd ever been in the IRA and just really without a backwards glance, just sold out all of his comrades from the struggle, driving them, many of them, berserk. I mean, they resented him so much. And yet, for me, it's hard not to feel that politically he came out in the right place, that you know, they couldn't fight the war forever. So, I'm left feeling a sense of irresolution. I should say Adams is probably no fan of my book. He didn't talk with me. People who are really zealous Adams supporters don't like the book because they think it's too hard on him. But people who are really zealous Adams detractors have issues with the book because they think I'm too soft on him. So in a strange way, to me, the having those two points of view out there is a measure of the book's success. I mean, that's what I wanted to do, right? Was not write a brief for one side or the other.
It's a measure of the book's success, without a doubt, but it also shows the complexity of this individual who has done all of these horrible things, compartmentalizes it, then ultimately is part of the crafting of the Good Friday Agreement.
Yes, and I think the Adams, and I sort of hint at the idea that there may be some aspects of his own past that have equipped him to be able to do this, but I think he's a great master of his own emotions. I think compartmentalizing is just the word. He's kind of a survivalist, and there's a lot of emotion in the IRA. There always was, and he manages, the fact that he's not hot-blooded, I think, has been a real advantage for him. But it puts him into tension emotionally with people like Dolores Price, who's as hot-blooded as they come, and ends up in a situation in which she says of Adams, "You sold us out with the peace process. You know, all those things I did those because we were told we would drive the British out. And then you compromised, which you're never supposed to do," in her view. And to make matters worse for her, Adams then denies that he was ever in the IRA. And she says, "Well, you can't do that. You were my commanding officer. You gave me these orders to do these things that keep me up at night." So the complexity of that dynamic just thematically felt very rich and interesting to me.
You say complexity, but really the toll that it takes on someone like Dolores Price is so devastating, especially considered when you compare it to Jerry Adams, who doesn't seem like it took a toll at all.
Yeah, I mean, that contrast, precisely that contrast between the weight of all this trauma on a bunch of these people, you know, to a point where they basically all drink and drug themselves to death. There's a wonderful line that somebody who knew both Brendan Hughes, the big figure in the book, and Dolores Price said, where, you know, I asked if Dolores Price had committed suicide, and this woman who knew them both said, "Oh, they both committed suicide for years." And there's that kind of self-destructiveness. And then you see Adams, who just doesn't have it. I mean, he has said that he sleeps well at night. And I believe he does. But I think it must take a huge kind of act of dissociation in order for him to be able to do that.
I spent a week in Belfast about a year and a half ago, and I was really struck by how much the troubles remain, which I was not aware of, like you, Patrick Radden Keefe, Joseph Christopher Francis Donoghue. I certainly have an Irish background. I did not know to the extent of how raw it still is, of how those murals and those martyrs are still very much a part of that city and of Northern Ireland as a whole. And that was really striking to me. And it seems like something that really is missing from the story that we are told in this country, that which, and maybe it's my own naivete, that after the Good Friday Agreement, that all kind of stopped.
Yeah, I mean, I'm with you. That was precisely my impression. As a not just an Irish American, but a you know, a kind of newspaper reading, relatively well informed adult, was right that there had been this terrible conflict for three decades, and then it ended with this landmark peace deal, and everything kind of came up roses. And I was astonished to go and just register the tension, the degree to which these are still divided communities, the degree to which, you know, in a book called Say Nothing, right, people don't talk about the past, they don't talk about these things, there's kind of a code of silence. As you say, there are murals everywhere. I mean, you know, what I think about is everywhere in these neighborhoods in Northern Ireland, particularly in Belfast, you know, I think about the 10-year-old kid who gets mm-hmm. up and walks to school or walks to the bus stop, and every day they pass a huge wall mural of a guy with a balaclava and an AK-47. And these are everywhere, you know, this kind of iconography of militarism.
Well, not to mention the walls themselves and the gates and the razor wire.
Exactly. I mean, they call them the peace walls is the sort of strange neologism that they use for these huge walls that basically divide the community. And so there's this sense that, you know, there's a peace, but it's, I think of it, some of these walls, it literally looks like fences in a zoo, the way you would cage animals, because if they were in the same pen, they would tear each other to pieces. So it is peace, but the infrastructure of that peace, you know, leaves you kind of questioning how durable it all is.
We don't have much time left, so I'm going to ask you a huge question, of course. and that is what you leave us with in the book, which is this idea and this hope that Brexit could unite Ireland.
Yeah, it's this strange postscript, really. I had I spent 4 years working on the book, and I couldn't have predicted Brexit. I don't think anybody could have. And it happened just as I was finishing up the book. And I think in the near term, it's already happened. I mean, Brexit has kind of driven back up a lot of these tensions. It's brought a lot of this stuff bubbling up to the surface. Initially, there was this fear that there'd be a hard border between the North and South. That hasn't happened. Instead, they've shifted the border into the Irish Sea for trade purposes. And that's actually got loyalists very upset because it appears to kind of sever Northern Ireland from the UK and bring it closer to the Republic. The interesting question for me in the longer term is part of what Brexit does is it forces Northern Ireland to choose between Europe and the UK, which it didn't have to do before. And I think if it's forced to choose, Northern Ireland will ultimately choose Europe and choose Ireland. And so you end up with this kind of perverse irony, right, that people like Dolores Price fought, and many of them died, and many of them killed people and took innocent lives for 3 decades to try and achieve this outcome, driving the British out, and they failed. And it's kind of crazy to think that with some historical perspective, it may be that what ends up bringing about that outcome is Brexit.
Patrick Radden Keefe is the author of the book Say Nothing, A True Story of Murder and Memory in Northern Ireland. The book is now out in paperback. Patrick Radden Keefe, a great pleasure to have you on the program. Thank you so much for spending time with us, and thank you for the amazing story that you told.
Oh, thank you. It was great talking with you.
A great pleasure. Thank you. We enjoy hearing from our listeners about our shows. You can email us at book@wamc.org and can listen again to this or find past book shows via podcast or at wamc.org. Sarah LeDuc produces our program. Bookmark us for next week. And thanks for listening for The Book Show. I'm Joe Donahue.